is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, about 50 African leaders are expected to attend a major summit December 13th to 15th in Washington, D.C. And Amnesty International is urging Nigerian authorities to probe the death of seven young men in the country's restive southeast. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. With 2.5 weeks to go, Kenya's presidential race too close to call. The top two candidates have booked the same stadium on the same day for their final rally, a potentially volatile situation in a country that has been racked by violence in previous elections. Four candidates are in the running, but Deputy President William Ruto and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have emerged as the strong frontrunners, drawing thousands of people to their rallies around the country. The French news agency AFP reported both of these parties say they have reserved Nairobi's Nyayo National Stadium for the last campaign day, August 6th, 3 days before the vote. Last month, police fired tear gas to disperse stone-throwing supporters of the two candidates when they clashed over access to a campaign venue in the east of Nairobi, forcing Ruto to take cover. More than 1,100 people died during the 2007 election. Some 22.1 million Kenyans are eligible to vote. President Uhuru Kenyatta has served the maximum of 2 5-year terms. About 50 African leaders are expected to attend a major summit December 13th to 15th in Washington, D.C. that President Joe Biden announced today to discuss pressing challenges ranging from food security to climate change. Biden said in a statement that the meeting will demonstrate the enduring U.S. commitment to Africa and underscore the importance of relations between the two, as well as increased cooperation on shared global priorities. As the U.S. has focused on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, and a raft of other international and domestic issues, China has been trying to bolster its influence in Africa, providing loans and major infrastructure projects. Russia has sent forces to help African leaders tamp down on insurgencies. A senior administration official discussing the summit plans on conditions of anonymity told Reuters that while the U.S. feels it offers a better model for partnership than China, Washington is not asking African leaders to choose between the two. Biden has visited U.S. allies in Asia, Europe, and Middle East this year. He has yet to visit Africa since becoming president. The summit will be his most comprehensive look at the complexities of the continent. Biden said he will aim to reinforce the U.S.-Africa commitment to democracy and human rights, mitigate the impact of COVID-19 and future pandemics, work collaboratively to strengthen regional and global health, promote food security, advance peace and security, respond to the climate crisis, and amplify diaspora ties. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken yesterday released the 2022 Trafficking in Persons Report, which is aimed at encouraging governments to beef up their anti-trafficking efforts. The report paints a mixed picture of success. The United Nations says 25 million people around the world are still in some form of forced labor. Have traffickers come up with new ways to dupe people and force them to slavery? VOA's Carol Van Dam put that question to Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, a U.S.-based coalition that combats forced labor and sex trafficking in more than 100 countries.
They have. Unfortunately, governments haven't come up with new ways to stop them. I think the most important two words that Secretary of State Antony Blinken used in introducing the report to the public was a mixed picture of success. So what the report does is rank countries around the world by tiers. Tier one is the best. Those countries are found to be doing what's necessary, meeting the minimum conditions necessary to effectively combat traffickers through prosecutions, through prevention programs, and through protection of survivors. Only 30 countries and only one country in Africa met that list, and that was Namibia. The reality is the rest of the world, the vast majority of the world, do not meet those minimum conditions, and 22 countries aren't even trying.
Let's stay on Africa for a minute. You mentioned Namibia is the one country that seems to be cooperating. Paint a picture of some of the other countries in Africa and where they stand on the human trafficking and the forced labor, which are both part of this problem.
Sure. If you look at a map of Africa in the TIP report, it color codes the different countries. And green is the color code in favor of being on tier one. You're hitting on all cylinders and doing what's necessary. Africa's a sea of orange and red and yellow for the other tiers, showing that those countries aren't effectively prosecuting, aren't effectively protecting people from traffickers, aren't effectively protecting those who are in trouble or targeted by traffickers or are on the way out, on the backside, are survivors who have escaped or been rescued. So it's a bit of a disappointing picture in that when we think about modern slavery, we immediately, the word slavery sends our mind back to 150 years ago, 200 years ago, where people were kidnapped from Africa and brought to Europe or to Asia or to the Americas. Well, unfortunately, today, in modern forms of slavery, it's happening right inside Africa, in mines, on fishing boats, at farms, inside brothels. And so we see children and women and adults who are kept in place through forced fraud and coercion.
Even here in the United States, we're not immune to that. We are found guilty, people in our country, of bringing in these domestic workers that are illegal, right?
Yes. Inside the United States, there's a system of guest worker visas, which are known as the H-2A and H-2B program. And then something also called the J-1 visa program for people who are camp counselors or au pairs or other kind of summer or seasonal work. These are people coming into the United States on legitimate visas. And often they find themselves in domestic work as maids or nannies or au pairs or working as gardeners or other kind of seasonal help. And they find themselves stuck to an employer and they cannot leave.
Which would you say are the people that are most often targeted around the world?
In some countries, a prevalent form of forced labor might be domestic servitude, say people migrating to South Africa and end up working as maids or as gardeners. In other places, it's cocoa plantations or rubber plantations in West Africa.
That was Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. During his recent Middle East trip, President Joe Biden outlined a five-part new framework for the Middle East that included supporting economic development, military security, and democratic freedoms. Biden also met separately with three Arab leaders, including President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of Egypt, where tens of thousands of political prisoners are locked up. President Biden made no comment on those issues when reporters were in the room for the first few minutes, instead thanking Sisi for the incredible assistance in Gaza, where Egypt has promised to help rebuild after last year's brief war between Hamas and Israel. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, discussed these issues with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
As you know, American strategic interest in the Middle East consists of securing oil and gas, international navigation, Suez Canal, the Red Sea, the Gulf, counterterrorism, securing the state of Israel. These are priorities. Other issues usually come second. They are on the agenda, but they are not at the top of the agenda. Human rights in U.S. foreign policy is only used in the area when the regime is unfriendly or when they want to put some pressure on a regime. For example, for decades, Saudi Arabia banned women from driving cars. We have not heard any talk from the Americans on this issue because the important thing was oil, and that was important. So tensions even began to emerge when the Saudis began to open relations with China and Russia. Today, the bilateral trade between China and Saudi Arabia is over $60 billion, while with the United States, it is only $19 billion. So this is when you began to talk about human rights, Khashoggi, and all this stuff. The credibility of the U.S. human rights discourse in the Middle East has been tarnished with B-50 democracy in Iraq, intervention in Syria and Yemen, while ignoring and even turning a blind eye to the fate of the Palestinian human rights under Israeli occupation. So such talk about opposition and human rights, democratization is a lip service. Most likely, Biden had promised before during the election campaign that he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah state. He will not give a carte blanche for Trump's favorite dictator. But now, because of the Ukrainian crisis, he had to break the long absence from the Middle East over 1 year and a half, coming to shake hands with the same people whom he had been criticizing. So the Biden talk in the, regarding human rights had to do with also his progressive radical constituency back home because of Congress election in November. And that's why he emphasized this issue. Real politics is now more important. Egypt has a Suez Canal where almost 14% of world trade passes through. Egypt plays a role in Gaza, in Libya, in Sudan, in counterterrorism, in balancing with Iran. So all those things are priority. The human rights, the political detainees come second and third and fourth, and maybe at the end of the list.
But John Kirby, a top spokesperson for the White House National Security Council, said Mr. Biden planned to address such issues of human rights with Mr. Sisi and other leaders in private. But many in the Arab world worry about Biden's commitment to human rights, especially in Egypt. Is that a legitimate concern?
It's normal in international relations that issues like human rights and climate change come later after real strategic interests. Political activists have learned from what happened under the Obama administration when the Americans abandoned the Syrian opposition as Russia invaded and supported the regime of Bashar al-Assad. At that time, the Secretary of State told the Syrian opposition, we are not going to fight Russia for you. And so it looks very clearly that political activists should not over-rely on foreign assistance and pressures while ignoring mobilizing their own local resources and providing attractive alternative programs.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shinawi. Officials are meeting in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, this week to expand the protection of land and marine wildlife. It's the continent's first ever Africa Protected Areas Congress. Despite little funding and the low quality of many existing conservation areas in the region, according to the Associated Press, the United Nations estimates just 14% of Africa's land and inland water ecosystems and 17% of coastal and marine areas are protected. The continent currently has 9,118 protected areas. Over 100 countries worldwide have plans to expand conservation efforts and protect wildlife from human-caused damage. Experts say climate change, underfunding for protected areas, and the growth of infrastructure development in protected areas are hampering biodiversity on the continent. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm your host, Yehayes Wuhib, in Washington. Amnesty International is urging Nigerian authorities to probe the deaths of seven young men in the country's restive southeast, where separatist tensions are on the rise. The French news agency reported that operatives of a government-backed security unit called Ibu Biagu are alleged to have killed the seven on Sunday in the Oru area of Imo State. But Amnesty International said the victims were returning from a wedding ceremony and posed no threat when they were shot dead. But Nigeria's State Security Services, known as the DSS, has claimed responsibility for the killings, saying the men were members of ESN, the militant arm of the outlawed Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB. It said the ESN members had opened fire on DSS operatives who had tried to flush them from their hideout where they allegedly were planning an illegal operation. IPOB agitates for an independent state for the ethnic Igbo people of southeast Nigeria. Southeast Nigeria has seen a surge in the violence blamed on IPOB or its armed wing in recent months. It's been 6 weeks since the arrest in Dubai of two brothers accused of stealing billions of dollars in South Africa, but the country is seemingly no closer to extraditing them. Atul and Rajesh Gupta allegedly conspired with former President Jacob Zuma to loot state-owned enterprises in a scheme known as State Capture. South African prosecutors and investigators say they're working with Interpol and others to try to speed up the extraditions from the United Arab Emirates. Here's Darren Taylor.
Zuma awarded many dubious contracts to his friends, the Guptas, especially during the last 4 years of his presidency between 2014 and 2018. The Guptas allegedly also somehow held the power to decide which African National Congress, ANC, officials were appointed to cabinet. A commission of inquiry has found that the Guptas, Zuma, and others in the ANC, helped by several international consultancy firms and banks, stole between 500 billion and 1 trillion rands. That's between $30 and $60 billion in today's numbers. The National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, has acknowledged that an administrative misunderstanding with UAE authorities initially delayed the extradition process. But the head of the NPA's investigative unit, Advocate Andrea Johnson, says this has been resolved, resulting in real positive movement.
This is, of course, very welcoming and this is very promising, precisely because the clock is ticking right now.
Justice and security expert Henny van Vieren is monitoring developments for the Open Secrets Foundation.
There is a total of 60 days which the South African authorities have in order to prepare their arguments and submit those in terms of the extradition matter. We're told by Advocate Johnson that the NPA is working hard on these and they will meet the deadline. And I think
But Member of Parliament and former NPA prosecutor Glynis Breitenbach remains concerned at the current shape of the extradition process.
You cannot add massive tranches of charges once you have the extradition done. To make those changes, you need the permission of the extraditing country. One would have expected the indictment to have been ready in time, not scurrying around now trying to add charges. That is a little concerning. I'm also concerned that the application has not yet been translated into Arabic. You know, we've got a lot less than 60 days left. They were arrested on the 8th of June. Time is running out, and the NPA really cannot afford, they really cannot afford to miss this one.
NPA sources have told VOA they're struggling to get cooperation from institutions in the UAE, especially banks where the Guptas are allegedly keeping stolen money. Not surprising, says van Vieren.
We know that the United Arab Emirates was a central node in the criminal enterprise that the Guptas have run. There's a reason why people like Guptas themselves have used this as a bolt hole. And that is precisely because the UAE has functioned and has profited from enabling these type of crimes for criminals like these across the world. And corporations in the UAE act very secretively and act as service providers to the very rich, to the very wealthy and the very criminal. And sometimes those are all the same people, as we've seen.
Van Vieren urges President Cyril Ramaphosa to exert as much political pressure as possible on UAE leaders to secure the help of Dubai-based companies to build a case against the Guptas. Meanwhile, South Africa continues to be racked by the consequences of corruption during the Zuma era. State companies, such as the National Electricity and Rail Corporations, are close to collapse. Long power outages are common and trains barely run. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the right to abortion has raised concerns among activists about a domino effect in developing countries, including in Africa. In Kenya, anti-abortion groups have welcomed the ruling, while abortion rights supporters fear it could further restrict the reproductive health of girls and women. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Anti-abortion groups in mainly Christian Kenya celebrated the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of the right to abortion in June, calling it a divine intervention. With her Bible in hand, Catherine Karira is a Christian youth mentor in Nairobi.
Abortion is murder, and the abortionists are also murderers. So when I see that the Supreme Court is choosing life, that is the way to go.
Kenya has upheld the right to abortion, but only for health reasons, leading many women to seek unsafe, illegal abortions on demand. After watching her friend bleed to death from one such abortion in Nairobi, a 20-year-old woman who prefers to remain anonymous told VOA she sought professional help when she wanted an abortion. She says she went to a good clinic, and the doctor took her through the process. Now I'm fine, she says. As you can see, I'm all well, I'm healthy, and I don't have any complications, she adds. She and other abortion rights supporters in Africa worry the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn abortion rights could encourage more legal restrictions in Kenya and lead to more deaths. The World Health Organization says 75% of abortions in Africa are unsafe. Kenya's Ministry of Health estimates 2,600 women and girls die each year from complications related to unsafe abortions. That is 35% of all maternal deaths. Duncan Mosigis is a nurse and a member of the Reproductive Health Network Kenya.
There is a high rate of maternal deaths resulting due to unsafe abortions because these women are denied the right to have the safe abortion services.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump restricted funding to developing countries' reproductive health services as part of the so-called gag rule against abortion. Abortion rights campaigners say that was the first sign that more action will be needed to protect the right at home. Martin Onyango is the Associate Director for Legal Strategies at the Center for Reproductive Rights in Nairobi.
While the U.S. has been very generous in supporting our health systems, we must be more proactive ourselves and have the right laws, the right practices that favor access to reproductive health, including abortion care.
Kenya has gradually liberalized its abortion laws to allow, in 2019, termination for sexual violence. A judge ruled in March this year that abortion care is a constitutional right and even cited the U.S. Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision that was then overturned in June. The judge's ruling is being challenged, and Kenya's abortion rights advocates worry the U.S. change in law might affect the final decision. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbilia Barrow, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.